Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're going to talk now about the Middle East, what's going on in Egypt and American policy, and what's going on in Palestine, Israel as well. We are here with Dr. Neil Rubin, former senior editor of the Baltimore Jewish Times, writer and educator. Phyllis Bennett is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of many books, including Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer. And Neil and Phyllis, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
So let's begin. We talked a bit about Egypt in the before we go to Palestine, Israel. We talked a bit about Egypt in the top of our program during our national news roundup, and what the American policies are there, and both in terms of realpolitik and what's happening on the ground. And Phyllis, I'd like to hear both your analysis very quickly. Some of you, Phyllis, about why the United States policy is what it is in Egypt. What do you think?
Well, I think the U.S. policy in Egypt is very consistent with what it's been really since the beginning of the Cold War. This has to do with the immediate. It has to do with Israel. It has to do with the Camp David Agreement. It has to do with traffic through the Suez Canal and access to Egyptian airspace. More broadly, the U.S. policy in the region as a whole has been a three-part policy of focus on oil, Israel, and stability. And those three things are what have determined what the U.S. does. So what we're seeing now is very consistent with that. The reluctance of the U.S. to identify the military coup as a coup is not just about the particularity of challenging military aid to Egypt, but it's more about the broad question of making sure that the U.S. comes out on the side of whoever is the winner. So it was the same reason that President Obama was so hesitant and waited so long before coming out against the deposed former dictator, U.S.-backed dictator Hosni Mubarak, and coming out in support of the new government, it was because it wasn't clear who was going to win. And the U.S. policy is always you support the winners. Most recently, that has led to a willingness, the first time in these last few years, we've seen this willingness to engage with Islamist-flavored governments, whether in Turkey or Egypt or Tunisia, the forces in Libya and even in Syria, much to their chagrin. They don't know what to do with that one. But this is all about looking at who's going to be winning in these struggles and maintaining that power. The immediate, as I say, is keeping the border with Israel secure and keeping the U.S. privilege of the Suez Canal. It's not about would we have access to the canal. Of course, everybody does. But the U.S. is privileged. U.S. warships always get to go to the front of the line. The same with U.S. access to Egyptian airspace. U.S. warplanes can fly over Egyptian space in part of the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, whatever they like, with virtually no approval needed. It's a very quick process, and it goes through instantly. That might not be the case with other governments, and so that's been a big part of the U.S. concern.
Yeah, the U.S. is basically playing a game of we don't want to bother with this right now. We've got too much going on. They're caught between short-term and long-term goals, and unfortunately they're not giving much credence whatsoever to the really messy transition to democracy. In some regards, it's analogous to what's happened in Turkey, although Turkey has a better history in terms of democracy, or at least a longer history with democracy. And the U.S. has really just backed off, and as Phyllis has said, is really seeing its short-term goals, which are long-term in their own right, too, but it's a very messy situation. The U.S. is not applying leadership in this situation to the world. It's ostensibly leaving it up to the Europeans, and the Europeans are at least as confused as the United States is.
Well, I wonder, and Phyllis, I'm going to jump in on something we talked about earlier in this and kind of talk about Egypt for a minute more here. I mean, that a couple of things. On the one hand, we talked about this, what's going on in Egypt, as also being part of a war on the poor, because many poor people support the Muslim Brotherhood. Out of the desperation of their economic condition, the one group that gave them hope was the Muslim Brotherhood, which is why many poor people backed us, who were mowing down thousands of literally poor people in the streets of Cairo as a precursor to what could be seen happening across the globe in other forms, A. And B, that part of this is a part that we don't talk about in terms of international foreign policy, which is the continuing battle over control of resources and access to things on the African continent between the United States and Western Europe and the Chinese.
All those things are at play. I don't think any of them are the dominant feature right now in Egypt. I think we have to be careful in looking at who are the forces supporting, not only supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, but opposing the military coup. It's not only poor people. We've seen a broadening of the anti-coup forces from just the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, who are also not only poor people. This isn't solely a class issue. There's a class element to it. Poor people are more likely to support the Muslim Brotherhood. Wealthier people are more likely not to. But it isn't an absolute, and I think we have to be a little careful in how we generalize around it. But beyond the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood itself, this new coalition, what they're calling the Coalition for Legitimacy, which of course has the Brotherhood, the Ikhwan, at its core, at its center. But it's much broader than that, because it's people who see the danger of a return to military rule. And despite the fig leaf of this so-called interim government, what we have right now is military rule, full stop. So I think that that's something that has broadened. We see it with the resignation of Mohammed al-Baradei as the vice president. We see it with the shift in the April 6th movement, which was a very secular, that was one of the iconic movements of the first part of the Arab Spring, young, middle-class, tech-savvy, English-speaking, that was crucial, English-speaking Egyptian kids that had taken a lesson from the trade union movement, from the labor movement, but had created this very different kind of youth movement. They pulled back from their support from the military. So I think that what we're seeing now, and this is going to be, I think, very important, is the rebuilding of an Egyptian population that for the first time in modern Egyptian history has an understanding of their own power and their own rights as citizens. They have reclaimed those rights. In the future, I think that's going to come back to haunt the military. Right now, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, unfortunately. I think we haven't seen the end of this horrific violence by the military and some violence by the opposition. But I think that in the medium and long term, we are going to see a massive shift as the people of Egypt come to terms with this notion of being citizens who have rights in their own country rather than being subjects of an imposed dictatorship.
Well, I wish I could be as optimistic in terms of the long-term outcome of what's going on here. One of the things that the military has done is it's united the Brotherhood as well as the Democrats, and it's given strength to the radicals in both camps. That's going to be particularly problematic as we go along. One of the things that the military has not been able to do is co-opt any of its opposition, and that's going to be a big problem for everybody down the road. It's why I've been calling for U.S. intervention along the lines not necessarily so different in terms of what they're doing with the Israelis and the Palestinians. We're just giving lip service to intervention right now, as different as the situations are in some regards. Right now, it's just become a political football in Washington.
Well, somebody said, Phyllis Bennis, that the Palestinians' negotiations are lip service as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest danger we face with Kerry's current initiative is that it might, quote, succeed, which would create something called a, quote, Palestinian state, which would be what an Israeli leader back in 2007 said, we'll give them whatever land is left over. They can call it a state. They can call it fried chicken.
Well, it's only going to succeed if Mahmoud Abbas agrees to it, and he's going to have to get it through the PLO Council.
Well, may well be pressured into agreement, or some other Palestinian leader. That doesn't mean it's going to work, because it doesn't mean that it's going to be just, comprehensive, lasting, or accepted by the Palestinian people. This is a leader who has his own problems of legitimacy. His term of office ended years ago.
Right, 6 years ago.
His term, as well as the term of the Hamas-led leadership in Gaza, both have expired. Neither have all that much public support. Neither of them can speak for their people. It's the reason that we're seeing such high commitments to secrecy right now. It's because all sides know that they don't have support at home. So when they sign off on something, if they do, it will be without public support. And the fact that both sides have said that this won't work unless they get a referendum, it's because they know that they don't have that support.
Well, I mean, one of the things, go ahead, Neil.
No, I was going to say, keep in mind, we're at the beginning of a process, and it's never been a clean process since it began in secret in 1992. And I'd like to tell people when I'm teaching on this topic, I'd rather live in a world where there are negotiations than one where they're not. As difficult as it may be, I know what happens when there aren't negotiations.
But one of the things, let me raise here, though, I mean, the one of the things, Leah Tarachansky, who was on the show on Friday or Thursday, days blur on the show sometimes, I apologize, but when Leah was on, she is an Israeli reporter from for the Real News Network. Mm-hmm. And one of the things Leah was saying was that she looks at this when she reports in the Palestinian territories, especially that the occupied territories, that the whole thing is seen as a farce.
Right.
This is not. I mean, if Israel is in fact going to build new settlements in Jerusalem, if Israel is not going to give up land that belongs to the Palestinians to start with, then and the people who are doing the negotiating, Mahmoud Abbas and the rest are kind of not legitimate leaders in terms of who people look to. They may control a very small portion. This to me is just a game to play, while certain forces solidify their power.
I don't think it's about being a game. I think that's a mistake. I think it's a business. This so-called peace process led by the U.S. has failed for 22 years. We're now going into 23 years of failed diplomacy. We see diplomat after diplomat standing up. I mean, the most recent, with the appointment of Martin Indyk as the U.S. representative, what better indicator could we have than nothing has changed? He's been part of this failed process for 15 years, and holds it up as, I'm the experienced one. Yes, you're experienced in failure. It's a shocking. Well, it's not shocking, I suppose. It's consistent. Let's put it that way. The reason it's getting very little attention in the occupied territories, and I imagine inside Israel as well as among Palestinians in the rest of the world, is not because it's a game, but because nobody takes seriously that it's going to have any change from the current situation on the ground, where Israel has complete impunity from the United States to continue settlement expansion, to continue land theft, water theft. We now see there's an article in Al-Hayat, a very well-respected Lebanese paper, claiming to have access to the proposed deal. I don't know whether it's accurate or not, but it certainly is consistent with what most of us have been writing for a long time about what a possible deal would look like when the U.S. and Israel decide that they have no choice but to create something they will call a two-state solution. It uses the route of the apartheid wall as a border, with all of the major settlements on the Israeli side, meaning about 80% of the 600,000-plus illegal Israeli settlers will be allowed to stay. All the major water aquifers are on the Israeli side. The Israelis will continue control of the Jordan Valley, at least for the foreseeable future. East Jerusalem will be, quote, shared for 10 years, and after that it's very unclear what would happen. Palestine would have no control of its borders, no control of its own water, no control of its airspace, no control of who comes in and out. And crucially, the right of return of Palestinian refugees would be simply taken off the table, and they would be offered residency somewhere in the Arab Gulf. This is the apparent basis. Now, as I say, I don't know whether that report in Al-Hayat is accurate, but it certainly is consistent with what many of us have said is what it will look like when they decide this is what has to happen. So, somebody like Mahmoud Abbas may sign off on it. That doesn't mean it's going to work.
Neil?
Well, first of all, that certainly might be something that the Israelis put on the table, but these are negotiations, and I wouldn't give any credence to it at all right now. As for whether or not the talks are getting any credence in Israel, they're definitely being taken seriously because people are threatened. People are threatened that they're going to lose a percentage of what they've fought for and lived for so long. So I wouldn't
necessarily... A percentage of their illegal gains, let's be clear.
Under international law, the settlements are illegal. There's no doubt about it.
Exactly. They may have fought for them, but they're illegal.
But there's also no doubt that a final settlement is going to maintain those 80% of the settlers or within the three major settlement blocks.
No doubt. I mean, that keeps being asserted as if there were no other side. Israel knows, Israel says, Israel claims it will keep that land in any possible settlement.
There's also going to be
some Israeli position.
There's also going to be some land swaps.
Who used to live on that land?
The vast majority of that land was empty before anything was built there.
Actually,
I've seen it go up. The vast majority of it was empty.
There's 400 villages that we can talk about earlier, and there were other villages and towns that were destroyed. There are some that have been destroyed by the wall. The city of Qalqilya, which is not even a village, it's a city of 40,000 people. I don't know if you've been there lately, but it's completely surrounded by the wall.
If you're talking about since 1948, that's a different story entirely.
But I'm talking about 67 at the moment.
No, the vast majority of the settlers live on territory or live on land that was empty. Har Nof, Maale Adumim, Ariel.
First of all, they are still illegal. So the point of whether some of them was empty land, the parts in Jerusalem were not. People were kicked out of their homes.
No, the vast majority of that, too, French Hill, areas like that. The vast majority of that was empty land.
Okay, so that makes it okay.
I didn't say it. I'm just correcting you.
But I mean, there are a lot of those settlements were also on groves where people were using, places where people shepherded their sheep. It wasn't like unused land.
Farmland is
what we said about the Indian land.
Some of it was Rocky Hills. Some of it was particularly Mahvay Adumim, for example.
Rocky Hills were owned by people and were used to graze sheep and to raise olive trees. You know, you're implying, I know you're not saying it, but you're implying this notion of it wasn't until the creation of Israel that made the desert bloom. The Jews made the desert bloom, I grew up with. You know, that's the mythology that fits right very nicely with Golda Meir's line that there are no Palestinian people.
Let me try to get a quick call to him before we have about 3 minutes left in this segment. So, Matt, you're on the air. Very quickly, Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, hello?
Matt.
Okay, yeah. I just wanted to say, you know, that since 1948, when and maybe even a little before that, when the Israelis were even allowed to occupy that land, that's when you started to have all of that chaos in the land. So when you see what's happening in Iraq, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Egypt, all of this in Libya, none of that was swelled up at the level that it is until the so-called Israeli take over that land, and they don't even belong in that land in the first place. That's not their land. So okay. They are the true terrorists in the Middle East, and it's unfortunate that all of the people of color are being slaughtered while they are just occupying that little small part, and they're basically.
All right, man, we're gonna have to cut it just because we're literally out of time, and we'll have like 30 seconds from both of our guests. Neil, 30 seconds.
Look, I'm glad that there's ongoing peace talks right now. Like I said earlier, I'd rather live in a world where there are peace talks and there aren't. Peace talks can bring surprise. They can bring surprise relationships which can lead something. That's a good thing.
Phyllis?
I would just say that peace talks are not good when they're used to disguise the fact that aggression in the form at the moment of settlement building and the continuing siege of Gaza continues. I don't think these are serious peace talks in the sense that I don't think they are aimed at anything remotely resembling a peace based on international law, equality, and UN resolutions. They are peace talks that are grounded in Israeli power, and they're not going to work.
Phyllis Bennis from the Institute of Policy Studies. Neil Rubin, thank you both so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. We're going to take a break. We're at the end of our hour, our 2 hours. I'm not breaking anywhere. We're staying now for Tell Me More and Michelle Martin coming up. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Mellon Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineers, Andre Melton. Our interns are Daniel Dupree, Alexander Rudy, and Sinead Hawkins. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. You can hear the show again, podcast our shows, find information about our guests and the work they are writing and they are working on at our website, steinershow.org. You can also download and podcast our shows and listen to them on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.